most of my friends do. They take not things that are, you know, outrightly say, I am gay, I am a dyke, whatever, but just take things, even things that are really politically incorrect, things out of popular culture, like the whole cult around supermodels. I mean, all the young dykes I know love the supermodels, know who they are, know what they've done, and, you know, all that kind of thing, and in a way take these sort of things and, I mean, take that and use it as a way of forming a new kind of radical dyke identity.
Mm-hmm. And it's taking elements that... taking elements from... actually, the supermodel thing, I'm just curious now, in terms of... That's a particular discourse. I'm not sure if everybody necessarily knows exactly what you mean by supermodel.
Oh, well, supermodels are the most popular models in the world. Cover girls, models, runway models, the people who model clothes, appear on the cover of Vogue. And there are always, at any given time, a handful of models who are the highest paid, most popular. Their faces are everywhere. And you just know who they are because their faces are everywhere. They're not just on magazine covers, but they're throughout television. And you just sort of get to know who they are. And, you know, they become, there's a sort of cult of personality around supermodels. And I think, in a way, they're the way that they kind of, in a way, that the way that they portray their gender identities and their sexualities is almost a kind of performance. They're mm-hmm. often hyper feminine, mm-hmm. and I think that's really appealing in a way to people who are by their very nature of being self-avowed gay or dyke or whatever, have a consciousness about identity and about gender and sexuality, and know that gender is not something that's fixed and prescribed. That is something that's constructed, and that you can play with it yourself, that you can construct, you can do various things with gender identity and sexuality yourself, and it becomes a kind of performance. It's like all the dykes who are obsessed with James Dean, I mean, dress like James Dean, act like James Dean. At that point, it becomes a kind of performance, a gender performance, where at the one level, you've got, like, on an anatomical level, you've got, like, a female body, which maybe has a particular kind of gender identity, should be feminine, but is a dyke as well, and then starts parading around like this hermaphrodite. I mean, you just got all these different things happening, and it's really, really interesting.
What are there any other... Would you feel comfortable in describing maybe places that young urban dykes are? From where are they cobbling things together? You mentioned the supermodels.
Oh, everywhere. Advertising, I mean, television. Television is a big source of these things. I mean, you've got... you know, this huge, huge number of dykes that watch L.A. Law because there's this, like, bisexual character who is... And her sexuality is never really outrightly stated. It's only ever played with in a very subtle, surface kind of way. But now you've got this huge dyke following that watches L.A. Law religiously because, you know...
It has, yes.
And you see that. You see it happening more and more on TV, this idea of playing with gender and sexuality, not in any kind of radical way, but I think these things get taken up. You've got, you know, of course, things like Madonna and Sandra Bernhard. I mean, but they're different because they self-consciously, I think, try to play with these notions of not a fixed gender identity.
Presenting something more ambiguous and...
Either more ambiguous or that, yeah, that has more possibilities, that is self-consciously has more possibilities, and sort of a nod and a wink to people who know the codes that, you know, this is what's going on, that when Madonna appropriates Vogue... I mean, we all know what voguing's about. It's about black and Latino men, you know, trying to be as real as possible, being whatever it is that they're trying to be it supermodels. I mean, that's one of the big, big roles, one of the big categories at the Vogue balls was supermodels and, you know, different kinds of drag, be it army drag or corporate drag or what have you. So, I mean, it just comes from music, mm-hmm. There's certain...
Videos,
I mean, anything that's... Any aspect of popular culture, I think, can... It ends up, at some point, being possibly taken up and made part. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's not like in the past, I think, where it... You know, there was this real element of political correctness where you could only like certain things, and you only liked things because... they were bi women or they had a correct political line or what have you. I think things have become a lot more subtle and a lot more diverse now.
Yeah, I think that that probably sums it up. That's exactly it, I think. When we were referring to the 70s women's movement, I think, again, as a generality, it was outright rejection of anything patriarchal and a redefining of women's space. And so naturally it took on separatist sort of tones, whereas now there's any number of women, of lesbians, who will call themselves feminists and lesbians, but the categories are enormous.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think what happened a lot in some earlier and even some present feminist theory is falling into the same traps of binarisms in terms of gender and sexuality, where, you know, there was no questioning this sort of male-female kind of binarism, in that it was just a reversal and just trying to privilege female qualities and the sort of things that are essentially, quote-unquote, essentially female, which I think was really problematic. But I also think that the possibilities were really rigid compared to, I think, now, that in terms of sexuality, I don't know, I just find a lot of early feminist writing to be pretty anti-sex, and that this has become a really important part of the young Urban Dyke and the way that she deals with the world around her.
I guess that was part of the process. And now it's 1991. And we're going to go to a musical break.
Sorry. Well, we're back, and it's Dykes on Mics. I'm Elizabeth with Deborah and Danielle Camogue. Thank you for coming in, Danielle.
It's great. A pleasure. Sitting in this hot little airless room, I'm about to pass out.
Getting dizzy, sweaty, and oxygen deprivation, just like a discotheque, huh?
No, not quite. The lights... Overhead lights here are bad. There's no beer.
No strobe and no really loud music.
No, so I guess can't hear anything. You guys have the headphones.
And this is true, and that's how we maintain control
power
of your show, exactly. But we're talking about constructs of identity in popular music, and you had a point to...
Well, I was going to say that, I mean, even though things have become... things have changed a lot in that, I mean, it's possible for... I mean, even going back to David Bowie in the early 70s, it's possible for boys to play with gender identity. It's possible for boys like Boy George to dress up like girls. It's possible for, you know, certain bands to be really obviously homoerotic. Frankie Goes to Hollywood having all these, like, leather boys in their videos, and it's incredibly homoerotic, and it's just very obvious, like, these things have a real gay sensibility. And that's okay, and you see that a lot in popular music now, but you still don't see, like, this sort of lesbian or dyke equivalent. And I don't know when we will see this, see more of a sort of, especially a more hip urban dyke sensibility. Mm-hmm. I think you do see that a bit in certain texts, like the George Michael Freedom video, which has, we were talking about supermodels, it has the top five models in the world in this video, along with a couple of boys thrown in who we don't really know who they are. They don't have this sort of personality.
They're sort of inconsequential to the whole dynamic of the video?
They are. I mean, they just sort of pop up, you know, every now and then. But the way the video is constructed, it's like all these girls in different parts of what seems to be this apartment singing sort of in ecstatic kind of poses. And the way that the shots are cut together, they look like they're sort of looking, you know, the eyeline gaze match shots, and they look like they're looking at each other and checking each other out. And there's this really hot scene in the middle where these women pierce each other's fingers with needles, and then they suck not each other's, but their own drop of blood. And it's just incredibly hot. And there's this, I mean, that's one of the few things I can think of that has this, like, real... Obviously, I mean, it doesn't matter that it was produced by men. It has this real sort of dyke and a very sort of dyke kind of homoerotic sensibility.
I remember something that quite shocked me seeing on television. It was Katie Lang singing from the Red Hot and Blue album, her love song.
Oh,
and
yeah.
She was standing tousled in the middle of her bedroom with her hair sort of very up, and obviously she'd been crying at least for 48 hours nonstop. And her face had been under lips so that the bags underneath her eyes were exaggerated. And she was looking her worst, no question of it, and deliberately so. And it was a static camera shot of Katie Lang in the middle of her tousled bedroom, sobbing more or less the words of the song about her lover having left her.
Mm-hmm.
So that was, when I think of a gay woman artist who's quite openly so, although she doesn't make political statements except for PETA, the ethical treatment of animals.
Yeah, but, cows are our sisters.
Yeah, well, yes.
It's true. If you play Western Stars backwards, you hear cows are our sisters. It's a message. Yeah,
really?
You do.
She borrowed from Revolution Number 9.
No,
is that
Yeah, it's true. I heard it on CBC. It's totally true. Do that. Spin your record backwards at home, and you'll hear cows are our sisters.
But that was interesting because it was a video of anti-aesthetic, and that was done by a gay woman artist, and that did have a very specific film aesthetic that was, in a lot of ways, after the sex, what happens.
Which video are you talking about? The Red Hot and Blue video was directed by Percy Adlon.
And it's the one where she's in her bedroom in a static shot, and she's wearing a nightdress.
No, this is the one where she's washing. This is sort of, it's a PWA kind of point of view. It's in from the Red Hot and Blue collection.
Okay, maybe it was definitely a torch song, and it was probably
from the Owen Bradley Sessions Shadowland.
Possibly,
those
yes.
were really mm-hmm. seriously torchy.
Yeah.
But
it was an anti aesthetic, and it was really interesting in that way. And
I mean, Katie Lang's an anomaly, though, mm-hmm. As far as what we're talking about. I mean, she's not, you know, popularity-wise, you know, in the ranks of a George Michael or a Madonna or even anybody who's at the top, currently at the top of American pop charts or on heavy rotation on Much Music or MTV. So, I mean, she's like one, what you could see as one sort of positive example Although I would say just as easily that George Michael is a totally positive example, too, and that I love that video, and I've probably worn my copy out from watching it single frame at a time.
Well, I wonder if we can write the supermodels and ask them to replace the copy.
Well, hey, listen, you know, the rumor is that one of the supermodels in the video, here I am, like, being totally unethical and probably outing someone, but that Cindy Crawford is apparently a big dyke.
Well,
and that just makes it much more exciting to watch. And that she appeared on the MTV Awards with George Michael, and they were just talking about how cute each other was and who had the cutest butt.
And I wonder who had the better stubble on the chin. Anyway, it's 3 to 8, and we're going to end with a piece of music that you selected, Anvil.
Yeah, it's The Anvil, which is a song by Visage, an early 80s British synth-pop band. And The Anvil was probably the most famous leather bar in New York. So this song is about... This bar actually was closed down because of as a result of the AIDS crisis in New York, it was forced to close down. So it's sort of a historical and it's about a certain scene from New York in the 70s.
So we'll go right into
the SM scene.
Well, it's 3 to 8. It's Steaks and Mikes. We've been with Danielle Comeau talking about virtually everything very quickly about disco. Good night.
Canadian literature that you've read?
Well, a little bit of W.O. Mitchell and Barney Mowat and a bit of Richler as well.
Is it important to you to find works by Canadian authors?
Well, I'm not doing as much reading for pleasure these days in the middle of studies, but yeah, I think it's important to have a Canadian publishing industry, Canadian authors, as well as other art forms as well. I think that there needs to be a level of government subsidy and the diminishment of that is a concern. My point is more on the issue of this parliamentary committee, and I'm a little surprised by the reaction of the panel and some of the callers as to the remarks. I mean, I'm not so concerned about the MP's personal attitude towards literature or anything like that, but I think it's dangerous if there's an immediate reaction against the idea of having to justify the artists, that is, having to justify their place in society. I think that's a positive process, and I think that I'm surprised that that the industry wouldn't jump to the chance to promote itself in that way.
Alberto, what about that?
Well, but they are doing that in that there was an answer. There was a report read to the commission, so they are doing that. The problem, I think, is not having to justify yourself. The problem is that you have to deal with the idea that somehow literature is not important, or what is worse, that somehow literature is elitist. Some of these people confuse the fact that they are not that the numbers reading are not very high with the notion that therefore it is an elitist activity. Reading is not an elitist activity. It is a right that we have as human beings. It is a need that we have as human beings, and it is a responsibility that we have as human beings. I can't stress that strongly enough. It is absolutely essential if we are to live in a civilized society to be able to read what we want, to be given the opportunity of reading, and to be taught that reading is essential as breathing.
Mm-hmm. True enough. My concern is more that as an industry funded by the government, regardless of the government's position and the author's position and so on, that somehow I'm getting this impression that there's a reaction that how dare the government challenge us or require us to you know, give account of ourselves, because in fact they are investing, you know, whether that's been decreasing or not, they have invested in the industry, and I think that there is a right to ask for an accounting.
Of course, there is a right to ask, but it is us from this point of view, from the prejudice that it is really not important. How popular is the raise that MPs have given themselves, for instance, and how have they justified that raise? How is the military budget being justified? How are just a number of things in the activities of the state? How are those being justified to Canada? They are not necessarily done from the point of view that this is not really necessary, so you have to prove the need for this kind of subsidy.
Listen, caller, thank you.
I agree. You should be able to prove it, but it's done at a different level.
You had another point?
Yeah, one more. I do agree that there needs to be justification to all levels in government, but I would like to jump on the point that was made earlier. It was just mentioned about reading in school, and it seems to me that it would be far more useful or very useful to spend more money and time promoting reading of Canadian literature in the school system. That is the place where you are going to inculcate that love of Canadian literature and that sense of Canadianness that we're the sort of talking about in all this.
Thanks for calling.
Okay.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Actually, it would be interesting. We heard from one professor. It would be interesting to hear from other people, particularly in the secondary and elementary school levels, about reading and reading generally, as Alberto and Judy have been saying, but also the place of Canadian authors, works by Canadians in the school system. Hello.
Hello.
Hi, where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Montreal, but I want to tell you that I just moved here from Winnipeg, and we miss you desperately out there. I really enjoyed hearing you in the morning, and my friends really, really were very sorry when you weren't there anymore.
Thank you.
I don't read a lot of Canadian literature because at this particular time in my life, I don't have a lot of time to read. But being from Winnipeg, I saw an awful lot of Canadian plays. And they stem from the same root, Sandra Birdsell, for example. I've seen quite a bit of her stuff, and she's a writer. So, I mean, we have to remember that this also goes into other areas. I'd also like to say that a couple of my points have been brought up before, but I think I have a slightly different slant. I believe that this remark that was made has a lot to do with the U.S. wanting to open up discussion again on cultural control. And this scares the hell out of me. I think this is a sign that people should be listening very, very carefully. The film industry is still very, very anxious to take over even a small bit of control we have over our film industry. And it has nothing to do, it's not Machiavellian, it's just sheer greed. And I hope people are very, very careful when it comes time to vote, because this really scares me. And I feel this remark was made almost as a feeler. And I also feel that it's not that this man is saying that Canadian books aren't as good as American ones. From the list of the junk he reads, I would say that they're not entertaining as much. And third point,
still
boggles my mind how ignorant our politicians are. I mean, why do we seem to elect, a pig farmer as Minister of Culture? How do we get into these situations? These are our leaders. And the ignorance of so many of our leaders, I really can't get used to it.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
So I want to point out that the same argument has been used about the CBC. I mean, so few people listen to the CBC, so why in the world continue supporting it? It has no place in Canada.
Well, the same argument was used for our railway.
Well, yeah.
And that was slashed.
That's right.
Slowly we'll be left with absolutely nothing except a Tory image of an American colony.
Let's go back to the phones. Hi.
Hi.
Where are you calling from?
Montreal.
Do you read works by Canadian authors?
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, when I go out shopping in a bookstore to buy books, it's a bonus if I can find a book that's not only a novel that looks interesting, but it's written by a Canadian.
Do you find that often, that the two come together?
Fortunately, there's bookstores like the Double Hook where you can actually go, and you know that whatever you look at, you're going to get something by a Canadian author. But I wanted to address some of the comments that have been made about cultural identity, and one of the callers mentioned that, literature is not unlike the other art forms. I can still remember as a teenager deliberately going out and overbuying Bruce Coburn and Joni Mitchell just because they were Canadian. I mean, not only did I enjoy their music, but it was a super bonus that also they were Canadian, and they sang about things that I could identify it with as a Canadian.
So you find then that's obviously important to you then?
Oh, absolutely.
You see, though, that it speaks to you as a Canadian. I mean, in what way? Do they throw in Canadian place names?
Absolutely. I remember the first time I read an Aretha Van Herk novel, and she talked about Calgary, and I could identify the streets. And I was living there at the time, and I thought, this is great. I'm not reading a book that talks about New York or Philadelphia or Los Angeles.
Right, but when you read, I don't know if you've read Margaret Atwood's, for instance, The Handmaid's Tale, where obviously they don't use a lot of Canadian locales because it's set in the future and it's sort of a nation-state business. But is that the sort of thing? Do you think you'd still feel a connection, even though there was no obvious sense of place in Canada?
Oh, absolutely. Because, I mean, Atwood, of course, she's our leading author, and anyone who's going to read Handmaid's Tale is likely written or read other books that she's written.
So thanks for calling.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Alberto, we're coming to the end of the show. I still want to take another couple of calls, but I have a question for you. I didn't want to forget about it. You've been in Canada now for about 10 years, not quite.